Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
Hello, this week, Debron Kelso returns to Anderson Lake with one of her favorite naturalist guides, Dr. Jeff Hammerson, along with field recorder Meg Amos and Debron's visiting sister Nancy. So let's walk along with them as they explore the wonders of the wild.
Oh, well, here we are finally at the lake. You know, part one, we thought we would get to the lake, but characteristic fashion, we didn't ever get to the place that Jeff had wanted to look for frogs. So unfortunately, where we are now at this little outflow, it's close to the road. So we're going to get a little bit of road noise, but it's a damp area here, and there are lots of little frogs leaping and dragonflies, and we'll all be looking now to see what we can see so we don't step on any of these little frogs moving.
Let's look at these dragonflies first. You can see this one especially. Oh, here's one close. There's several of them. These are paddle-tailed darners. And they're named that because at the end of their tail, they have these projections that look like little paddles. But they are one of the hoveriest. That's really not a word, but I just made it up, I think. But
Frog. They
hover in one place for a long time. This is one of the few dragonflies where you can get pictures of them in flight hovering because they hold in that position long enough for you to actually focus on them and snap the shutter. And I've gotten some fairly decent pictures of these. It's a common species. You see them a lot this time of year, patrolling around the edges of a wetland or a pond.
Are they looking for, like, mosquito larvae? What are they looking for?
Little flies, midges, any kind of little flying insect. They have huge eyes.
Compound eyes.
See very well. Yes, huge compound eyes, and they're very colorful. In fact, these have blue eyes, at least partly blue. And they also look out for each other because, during the mating season, the males compete for access to females and all that. So there's that social behavior going on at the same time that they're also probably looking for food. So right now, this one is like right 10 feet from us.
In the scummy little area, which probably is teeming with food.
It's duckweed on the surface of a pool here at the outlet of Anderson Lake.
And what will happen with dragonflies then? Will they, what happens when it gets cold?
In this particular species, the adults will die off, but the larvae will spend the winter in the water. So you can always find this species present, but it's not in the flying stage except in the warmer months of the year.
Uh-huh.
So once it hits the colder months, these guys won't have anything to eat and they'll die off. And but their larvae, their immature stages, will be their predators also.
Yep.
They'll be lurking around in the bottom.
Well, they're really voracious predators, aren't they? Dragonfly larvae.
If you ever want to have like nightmares, look at the jaws.
The mouth parts.
I have. Of insects in general. It's like, holy cow. So, but we're going to proceed here on this path, and it's a damp area where we have a good chance of finding some frogs. So we've already seen a couple jump. Let's go along and see what we've got.
Meg just spotted a big red-legged frog.
Yeah, it's a lot bigger than... That's a tree frog there.
That little one?
Yeah, that little one up on the leaves. You know it's a tree frog because it's the only frog around here that climbs up onto the vegetation. These, we'll get to their characteristics that allow them to do that in a minute, but let's get back to the frog here, the red-legged frog that's sitting out of the water, but in a totally wet area.
Right? Is that the
adolescent from the year before last? Not this breeding season, but last year's, and so it's not fully adult yet, but it's bigger.
And that's determined by size.
Yeah, by size you can roughly get it. Once they get to adult size, then you don't know how old they are, they can live several years, no problem. But a big, an adult would be twice that size. So that frog is 6 feet from us, kind of on some wet mud with duckweed on it. But closer to us, Nancy spotted a little tiny frog up on the leaves. And that, I see it. It's right under there. It's a Pacific tree frog, and it's a young of this year. Just came out of the water, probably back in June or July, and is now out foraging. And that one is just perched very quietly on a leaf next to a big tree that's right at the edge of the water. Oh, the red-legged frog just hopped. The little tree frog is just sitting there on the leaf. And it's probably looking for little insects that it could gobble. Those little frogs have different, whole different lifestyle. They're both frogs. These two species were seen, but they're totally different. The red-legged frog has skinny toe tips that allow it to just, they have webbed feet and allow they swim really well, but they can't really climb very well. But the tree frogs have, at the end of their feet, these expanded toe tips that have...
Kind of like geckos.
The same principle. Same principle, yeah. They're expanded at the tip, and they have a microstructure that allows them to interlock the toe tips with any little irregularity in the stuff they're climbing on, whether it be a tree or leaves. And they can jump from one leaf to another and cling to it. The toe tips are so clingy, but they're not sticky. There's a little mucus there that is, gives them a little surface tension, which is a way of adhering to things. Like you could lick your finger and pick up a little fragment of leaf. That's surface tension. You know, it's not really stickiness per se, but they have a microstructure on their toe tips that interlock, so it's a mechanical kind of thing. So they have no trouble climbing almost anything, vertical or even more than vertical. They can go up things that are inclined backwards, so to speak. And they spend a lot of time up on the plants I discovered where I live. And after they fill their bellies up, they'll bask sometimes. These don't have access to sun right here at this moment. But where I live, they get up on the salal leaves and bask in the sun, and they warm up. Another guy and I did a study years back on a different tree frog species that has the same kind of basking behavior. And they truly do warm up. They can get up into the 80s Fahrenheit with their body temperature when the air is quite a bit less than that simply by basking. And you think, well, oh gosh, you know, that's great, but then wouldn't they just dry out? But these tree frogs have semi-waterproof skin, so they can actually bask for quite a long time, and they're losing water, but very slowly, so that they evaporate enough to not overheat, but don't evaporate so fast that they dry out. And so there's a balance there. It's a water balance thing, but the warmer they get, the faster they digest their food, faster they grow, and if they get bigger, that's better for them. The survival chances for a big frog are better than a small one.
So this teeny little frog, then by next year, will it be breeding age?
No, it'll take at least 2 years. Around here, probably 2 years for the males and maybe 3 for the females.
Last time, you were starting to tell us about frog sound and your theory on why they call when it's not really breeding season.
I'm only speculating, because what I'd really want to do is see who is making those sounds. Like right now, you're going to hear it more and more over the next couple months, frogs calling in the forest. And what we really want to know is, are those big adults calling? Because some of the calls are kind of weak and pathetic sounding, actually.
Like an adolescent kind of trying.
And some of them are a little stronger than that. But or are they little juveniles or younger frogs that maybe will mature next year? And what are they doing? Maybe they're kind of getting their vocal apparatus working, and mm-hmm. maybe those muscles have to develop. And maybe as they're growing, they have to also mature their vocal apparatus. in order to make the proper sounds when the breeding season starts. That's a guess on my part, because I can't think of another advantage for calling, because there's, you know, they're not defending anything. Like, their food is dispersed, and there's plenty of places to hide in a forest. There's a million places to hide, perfect little nooks to stay moist and everything. It's not like there's a shortage.
And in terms of attracting a mate, it's not for that purpose either.
No, it's not interested in that. So anyway, nobody really knows, and I try really hard to find these frogs when they're calling, but they shut up as soon as you get close, and you can never tell who it is that's calling. So mystery still unsolved.
Yes, indeed.
But there's some bigger plants up here where we might be able to find some more frogs, even up higher. This little one that we were looking at was just a foot above the ground or so, but let's look up ahead and see if we can find any others that are taller,
that
or higher, I should say.
Good. So now we've gone a couple more feet in, and we're right at the edge of the outlet pond, and we're seeing all kinds of little red-legged frog heads of different sizes.
Yeah, well, here's one. It just landed on top of another one.
Well, do you think that if we could clear this area, we'd see all kinds of little frog heads?
Mostly out of the water right now, and we're finding them on land, which is where they're feeding, and they're using the water as a refuge. As we come up close to them, then, you know, they're kind of wanting to get into a secure place, and so they're hopping into the water, but they're sitting there with their heads out among the duckweed. There are a lot of them. Oh, here's another one. There's another half dozen right here. So it was a good year. So these are all young of this year, and they were produced in Anderson Lake, or in this wetland that's connected to it. So apparently not being harmed by the cyanobacterial toxins. At least it appears that that's the case.
Well, that's a blessing. Yeah. We are now in a place with a bunch of Indian plum, and we are seeing little tiny tree frogs all over them.
There's a couple above our heads.
That's probably about 6 feet tall, right? And the other one almost 7 feet tall.
Yeah, and they do, I don't know about these little tiny, tiny ones. Oh, here's one jumping. It just came off of a fern, and now it's on the Indian plum. Little tiny one. Yep, there's another one back there on the Indian plum. That one's a few feet above ground.
You know, Jeff, do they have the ability to change their color to camouflage?
They do.
Because I saw one that was kind of brownish, and I know that some other species of frogs can do that in a really pretty dramatic way.
There's a brownish
way.
One back
yep.
in there.
Oh, there's another one jump back there. Yeah, they can change color. They differ among different individuals in color and pattern, and so there's that variation. And then within whatever kind of basic color and pattern they have, they can change to a certain degree. So they can become greener or browner.
In contrast to the vegetation that surrounds them.
They often match pretty well. Yep. I see them basking on salal leaves. A lot of them match perfectly with that color.
Well, this one that's on the green Indian plum is, you know, laying flat, and it looks like a gall. It doesn't look like it's a frog at all.
They change color slowly, though. It's not a rapid change, so it happens gradually. So you're not going to see them, like, jump from a yellow leaf to a green leaf and immediately match. Oh, look, there's two side by side right there. Oh, that's a great photo.
You know, we just see their little rumps. They're pretty darling.
To this particular plant is that it's near an opening, because, like I said, they do like to bask. And so these are like jumping among the branches and leaves of a Indian plum that's pretty big and bushy and goes way over our heads. But it's open near an opening so that, like, tomorrow morning, they're going to be able to be in the sunshine. So they're feeding now, they could have full bellies, and tomorrow morning they could sit out in the sunshine for a while and bask and warm up and speed along their digestion.
Also thermoregulate in a shrub like this by changing their position on it and also getting in the shade, getting underneath a leaf.
Yeah, it's really easy for them to get full sun, full shade, something in between, and changing perches, no problem. Because you just see them, they just jump from one leaf to another with no problem at all. And the other frogs that we were talking about earlier, the red-legged frogs, could never do this. They cannot jump from leaf to leaf. They just can't even hang on to the leaf. They would be on the ground. And that's where they live. That's their niche, is on the ground. And not that the tree frogs don't do a lot of foraging on the ground as well, but they have a whole new, whole additional habitat open to them.
It's so funny because you never, unless you start to look, I mean, look at that one that's flattened on that big leaf there. They look like insects or something.
There are so many of them on this patch. I mean, we're talking about something that's a dozen feet. Let's say if we extend a dozen feet from where we are, wait for that truck to go by. So we're standing at the edge of this little thicket, and if we just extend a radius of like 12 feet on one side of the path here, how many frogs have we seen on the leaves here?
Well, they're probably 20.
We've probably seen right close to us at least 10, maybe a dozen or more.
Yep.
And I'm sure there's some, until they move or until you examine each leaf carefully, it's hard to appreciate them.
See their shadow.
Yeah, that is cool because there's one silhouetted. It's up on top of a leaf and we're looking underneath it. We can see its shadow silhouette through the leaf. And then that one over there is all tucked in. That's another thing when they're basking or just sitting quietly. They tuck their legs in. That one climbed up a little higher. But they kind of get all of their like thin body parts all tucked underneath their toes and legs. I think that probably helps conserve water in those parts of the body that are thin. And so they become this little lump of a frog that doesn't have thin extensions that might dry out on a day where the sun's beating down. But they can still, if they just cover up their toes and their legs and hunker over, they can warm up and not dry out too much.
Very cool.
Yeah, this is a little special spot I'm going to come back to in future years to see if this is kind of a habitual
norm,
thing. We just found this by accident, really. I never really looked for them here before at this time of year. It'd be easy to walk right by and not know they're there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Be really easy if you're just on the trail, on your horse or on your bike or on your feet, just making tracks, you go right by this and not know that there's a whole population of frogs on the leaves watching you go by.
Sweet. Well, you know, we've been so focused on amphibians that we haven't been looking at the vegetation, we've been looking at it, but we haven't been speaking about the vegetation, and it's quite varied here at Anderson Lake, and we've just come by some snowberry, and rightly named. It's got pure white berries, and Jeff was going to talk about these.
Yeah, like this is a good one to talk about because everybody can recognize it. The white fruits are pretty distinctive. It's common, and so even like so through the fall when the plants lose their leaves, you still see these masses sometimes of snowberry fruits. And sometimes when they're right next to roses with the rose hips together, it's really like beautiful juxtaposition. But I always asked myself, you know, like, gosh, these like fruits are hanging there. It's like it's fall, it's winter, it's spring, they're still there. And so I was like, what is eating these things? They are nutritious to eat, but apparently they're not a top choice because they last so long. And that's actually might be their strategy, is like the amount of time that they last, they can just last long enough so that there's nothing else to eat. The things that eat fruits will have to eat these and they will eventually get dispersed. So what have I seen? I've seen in the spring, robins pluck these and eat them. So I said, finally, okay, you would think that a robin would eat, that they eat lots of fruits, they would eat these, but they wait. And it was like March, I think. So these will stay.
They're like the potatoes. I mean, they're like, they're like preserved on the vine while the robins eat everything that's going to go soft. Yeah. And then they choose these. Are they more starchy than a regular berry? They feel like they're kind of springy.
I think they have kind of
a pithy.
They have a soapy type of material in them that makes them not that good to eat. So we don't eat them. But the other thing about them was I found a particularly nice clump last year, and I took pictures of them. So they were like, I don't know, a few clumps were close together, and there might have been 30 or 40 fruits all in one place. So I'm going to take a picture of these.
And I'm going to notice how many go missing.
So October, November, every month, December, January, February, March. And what happened to them is nothing took any of those, but they started shriveling up and drying, and maybe one or two went missing. But pretty much they just were there the whole time and eventually dried up and it was like disappeared. And so I'm like, gosh, these things aren't really that attractive to most things. It seemed like even robins, it's like last resort. But this last year, I also saw, I was watching a deer feed on Himalayan blackberry fruits. And I said, wow, I haven't seen that before. I got some pictures of it. And then it switched over and started eating snowberry fruits.
Oh.
And I'd never seen that before. So deer are one of the consumers of these. And deer also eat those spiny, they'll eat the, you know, the tips of the branches of the Himalayan blackberries, and also, well, salmonberry is the same kind of thing. It has kind of spiny foliage at not the foliage, but the branches at the tips are kind of spiny, but they just eat those. But this deer was plucking the ripe fruits off like mad. It ate a lot of them, and then, like I said, it switched over to snowberry. So anyway, it's an interesting fruit in that it lasts so long, and it seems like it's not getting eaten by things, but I think it's a role in the ecosystem is kind of the opposite of like blueberries that, you know, they ripen in the summer really early, and then there's other plants that ripen in the fall. Well, these ripen, but then they're very long lasting, which like a blueberry doesn't,
rot.
Or like
yep.
a blueberry would never last that yep. long to begin with. So this strategy is just last a long time. Ultimately, I'll be the only thing left to eat, and then I'll be eaten and my seed will be dispersed.
Yes. Once again, we've run out of time. We've gone, a half a mile into Anderson State Park, but it's been very fun. Thanks so much for joining us and being our guide.
Well, my pleasure, as usual.
We're very lucky to have so many great state parks to explore in our area. And we'll be back for part three sometime down the road. So thanks a lot to Jeff for being our guide, and to Meg for being our field recorder, to my sister Nancy for being the photographer, aide-de-camp. And thanks also to Nora Petrich for being our sound editor, and to all of you for listening. Our closing music this week is Lake Song by the Decembrists. As always, wishing you happy trails.
Down by the lake, we were overturning pebbles and appending all the animals alive. I took a drag from your cigarette and pinched it between my finger and my thumb to let it die. And the sun burned low on the radio. Say that you will, say you will, or will you, won't, or you, whatever you prevaricate your whole life, don't you? And this much I can say,
would have waited till the oceans fell away and all the sunken cities would reveal themselves to you. But you won't, will you? Because you never do. And the sun burns through. Sweet as honeydew. And I, 17 and terminally vain, well, I wrote it down and threw it all away. Never gave a thought to what I made. And you, civil line, you tethered me to you. The things you would, the things you would do. Tell the truth, I never had a clue.
Dungeness River Nature Center is pleased to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature, Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.